Hey, everybody, how's it going?
I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I named it that because it's my name, you know. Yeah, should be a good show for you. I guess, geez. Here, let me play. No, I got no audio. Well, just bear with me. Hello? Hello? I missed it. Oh, hi. Hi. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, perfect. I'll call back then. Thanks a lot. Yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. Okay, perfect. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Okay, bye. All right. Sorry. I was going to say I'm 90% chance I'll have Eric Margolies on. That was me wrapping up the Eric Margolies interview arrangements. That's how it's done. There you go. Fascinating peek into how the show works. You think Eric could do the show today? All right. I got to join up the chat room, man. I'm behind on my chores here. I got to join up the chat room. You too could join up the chat room. It's an IRC free node chat. If that means a thing to you, then you know exactly what I mean. If that doesn't mean anything to you, then don't worry. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat. You put in a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. You don't need any sort of external program or application or whatever the hell. Just your plain old browser window, scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out in there if you want. Also, you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Boy, it's a mess over there on my Twitter feed. That's the perfect technology for attracting crazy people. I'm not excluding myself from that, but yeah. What a thing. All right. Yeah. Boy, I got to cough again. Hang on now. All right. Now I'm done coughing for at least a little while. It's my show. Coming up on the show today, Colin Powell's former right-hand man, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Colin Powell's aide for, I don't know how long, a long, long time. And yes, he is a guilty co-conspirator who lied you into war. And he admits it and is sorry. He really is sorry. And he's been doing, especially, you know, back when he first changed his mind, but he's an anti-war guy now, trying to make up for it, and for example, he loves telling the truth, as he knows it, about the torture regime that Bush and Cheney instituted. And so Lawrence Wilkerson is going to be on. Okay. Also, Eric Margolies is going to be here. Now, mostly, I want to ask Eric about the war. Because, hey, we got to pay attention to the war. There's a war. And, you know, the torture regime is as important as it could be, but we can't let it take our eye off the ball going on in real time here. I saw where Time Magazine made the Ebola doctor man of the year. Boy, are they the biggest cowards in the world or what? As though Caliph Ibrahim is not man of the year. As though Omar Baku al-Baghdadi, I might have left out one of his middle names, is not man of the year. The guy who created a new state between in lawless former Western Iraq and lawless former Eastern Syria. Ratcheting up the regional sectarian war to 11. Oh no, it's the Ebola doctor is the man of the year, huh? Whatever, guys. What a joke Time Magazine is anyway, who cares, but that used to be a tradition with some import. You know, they would give man of the year to Hitler or Stalin or Mao or the worst devils because it wasn't a question of who do you like the most. It was the question of who was the most important individual on the planet. And now, it's the protester, the Ebola doctor. Get out of here. Anyway, that's stupid. So, Margolies, I want to ask him about the war, but I want to let him talk about the torture program, too, if he wants. He's got smart stuff to say about a lot of things a lot of the time. But now hear this. As you may know, Dana Priest broke a story back in 2007. You know, honestly, it could have been late 06. I forget. But Dana Priest broke a story about black sites. Now, we already knew about the black sites on ships at sea in Thailand and a couple other places. Some stories have come out about the CIA's rendition program and their secret prisons. But she talked about secret prisons in Eastern Europe. And then it was my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, not my wife at the time, but she is now. She's the one who named the names that, and I don't know if it was Dana Priest's decision or not. It probably was the Washington Post boss's decision to withhold the names of the countries at the request of the U.S. government. I assume the last part there, actually. I don't know if it was maybe just because they're cowards or what. But anyway, so Larissa went ahead and she wrote this story with a guy named David Dastich, who was a Polish intelligence official or a former one. Anyway. Called Soviet-era compound in northern Poland was site of secret CIA interrogations, detentions. And the point of this is not just to pat the wife on the back. You've heard me mention this on the show recently a couple of times. But the reason I'm mentioning it again now here is to, well, and even then it's in context about other media criticism and whatever stuff. But here, it's to defend her, or it's to point out that she doesn't really need defending, actually. And that is because the former Polish president has now admitted to the CIA torture site after spending years trying to cover it up. And when, in fact, he sent his prime minister and his head of Polish intelligence out to call my wife a liar back in 2007 when she wrote this article, they said, no, this story, a raw story, is completely not true, and it's only about... Oh, and you know what? I think the date at the raw story thing here is wrong. I think I got my dates of these reports wrong. I think this was before the midterm election of 2006. I think we got bad HTML on this page. But anyway, the prime minister and the and the head of intelligence said that she was a liar and basically, suggested that this was just partisan politics. She was some Democratic Party operative leaking a lie about Poland just to try to make George Bush look bad. That was his excuse. That was what he said. Well, here, years later, the president of Poland admits that it's true. We've all known it's been confirmed 8 ways from Sunday since then. But anyway, here it is where the Senate Intelligence Committee staff went and dug it out of the CIA's own files and proved it. And now they're admitting to it. Former Polish president admits to CIA torture site here. And so there you go. She's not a liar. She's not a Democratic Party operative. Actually, she's a badass investigative reporter. And that's one of, I don't know, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of killer stories that she broke for rawstory.com. And so screw you, Polish fascist torturer sock puppets of communists sometimes, Nazis at other times, the Americans. Boy, the government of Poland, they sure do love to do the bidding of foreign empires. It's like they exist only to serve criminals from other countries. I wonder why the people of Poland let them be the government of Poland at all. Don't you? These servants of Nazis and communists and Americans. These torturers, these liars.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
Hey, maybe we should just listen to Turbo Negro all afternoon. What do you think? I think I might prefer that.
You might too.
All right. Well, so yeah, it's the show again coming up, the heroic Eric Margulies and the not heroic, but I do believe redeemed Lawrence Wilkerson. That's my own judgment, and I love judging people. Not that I have the ultimate power, you know, but anyway. Tomorrow, Jeffrey Kay is going to be on the show. He is a psychologist who works with torture victims, has in the past especially, I guess. I don't know if currently he's doing that. But he's a real expert on torture, on the history of torture, and on the role of the American Psychological Association in playing along with the Mitchell-Jessen torture program under the CIA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's just brilliant and great and hardcore on this stuff. He's at dissenter.firedoglake.com. He writes over there with Kevin Gostela. You've heard him on the show numerous times. Jeffrey Kay. That'll be on the show tomorrow. And also, I'm going to be on the Tom Woods show tomorrow. So all you Tom Woods fans out there, you'll get to hear me on the other side of the interview thing. And it's going to be on the torture question. I am fairly clear. All right, so yeah, now I talked about the Poland thing. Now I got to make sure and talk about, well, you know, that could actually wait till the Margulies interview too, now that I think about it. In fact, that probably should, right? The whole Israel-Syria thing. Did you see all that? You know, they always say, boy, when something real big, even if it's something important, something real big is capturing your attention, boy, you better look for the, what's the magician's other hand up to? There's always something else huge going on. News breaking about the Israeli role in the Syria war. I'm going to actually go ahead and save that for the Margulies interview. I'm willing to bet he's up on that question. So good. I will get back to the torture then. So I do want to talk about it. I think it's important. Here's what I think is the most important thing for you to know about the torture report itself. Not about the torture, but about the report. What's the most important thing to know about the report is this is only about the CIA's role in torturing their prisoners at their black sites. And it's not comprehensive. Philip Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer, writer at the American Conservative magazine, was on the show yesterday or 2 days ago, said, hey, what's not in there is going to be the worst. Trust me, this is only what the CIA officers put on paper. But all the worst stuff, they didn't put on paper. So, for example, if they actually went and got some prisoner's mom and cut her throat in front of them to prove their point, which is not beyond them to do, that just wouldn't have ever been in the documents. They would have never put that in the documents. We would never find it out that way. You know, it's amazing the stuff that they did admit to in their own documents, knowing that at least there was it was conceivable that someone would be able to, on the outside of the CIA, would someday be able to put their eyeballs on them. But anyway. Very narrow focus here, because what really happened was George Bush called off law. That's what he did. He said, the Geneva Conventions don't apply to us when we're dealing with these people, and our signature to them doesn't apply. And any laws along those lines, they just don't apply. The president is the commander-in-chief, and that's it. That's the only phrase of the entire Constitution relevant. He's the commander-in-chief. He can override any law, any treaty, any law implementing any treaty, anything. As John Yoo, one of his lawyers, put it in response to a question from, I believe, a Cato Institute staffer, and get your kids out of here before I say this, or turn the volume down for 25 seconds before you come back. The question was, so you're saying the President of the United States could crush a child's testicles in order to get his father to talk? And John Yoo said, well, you know, it would depend on why the president thinks he needs to do that. But of course, no, John Yoo's entire argument is that, no, it doesn't depend on why he thinks he needs to do that. It depends only on his will alone. And it's unreviewable by any outside power. That's his entire argument. So when he was put with the ultimate question of what torture may the president participate in, all he could do was obfuscate. What he meant was, yes, the president has absolute and total authority to break any law, to override, to cancel any law, to do these things. And that memo was rescinded by Jack Goldsmith, who came in and became the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the White House. He looked at these memos and he said, not under the American Constitution, and ripped them up. Wrong, rescinded, big red rubber stamp. On the very worst of that. But that was the premise. Oh, see, I got sidetracked on that point. That was the premise, but what that meant was it wasn't just the CIA. It wasn't just even the top tier of special forces. It was basically the entire Army, the entire Marine Corps. It was everybody. It was both wars. Grab whom you must. Do what you want. The rules are off. We are now embracing the role of evil monsters in order to teach these guys a lesson, right? That was the overall thrust of the entire thing. And a huge percentage of the American people were for it, too. We could have gone all Harry Brown style. Hey, world, watch us. You know that we're armed to the teeth and could blow up the whole world and all that, but watch. We're going to hunt down and kill bin Laden, Zawahiri, and their 24 closest friends. At the same time, we're going to bring our entire empire home from the Middle East, where it doesn't belong. And I'm going to sit here and talk about the Statue of Liberty some more. And I'm going to tell the American people, I know you're angry, but let's just mourn and not give in to hate and evil. We will cut the throats of the guys responsible, or, you know, try them if we can catch them alive. But we're not going to war. We're not using it as an excuse to double down our empire. We shouldn't have an empire anyway. America is supposed to be a temporary, limited constitutional republic under the rule of law, founded by men who had defeated and seceded from an empire, the world's most evil empire ever, the British. We're not supposed to be an empire. Empire is murder, suicide. Every schoolboy knows that. And we could have gone that way. The American people could have elected Harry Brown in the year 2000. The attack wouldn't even have happened. But anyway, we could have gone that way, and instead we went for, no, you call us an evil empire, we'll show you evil empire, saying the entire right and a good third of the left in unison. And so there they went. This torture report doesn't include all the men who were kidnapped and sent to Muammar Gaddafi, to Hosni Mubarak, to Bashar al-Assad, to be tortured, to be killed by George W. Bush. It doesn't cover all the people who languished in the Iraqi prisons, 90% of whom, according to the U.S. Army, 90% of whom were entirely innocent of defending their homeland from foreign invasion. And the thousands of Afghans, of course, who've gone through the jails. And all the Iraqis who were tortured at military bases and camps in their own houses. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. I'm sitting here Googling up Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure on Netflix for Eric, because he's never seen it. Can you believe that? He's never seen it. Yeah, oh, here it is right here. I'm going to send you the link. Hey, guys, welcome back to the show. Yes, I am watching Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure out of the corner of my eye. It's one of my favorite movies. That's how we learn about history, right? Yeah. So I was recommending it to my friend Eric. He's never seen it before. Hey, welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing? What, I hit the wrong button or something? No?
Uh-oh. Eric, is your mic on mute somehow? We're definitely connected. I didn't screw that up. Oh, there's a problem with this call, it says. It's Skype's problem. You know, this is the thing. Isn't it daily on this show? This trade-off.
Hello?
Hey, there you are.
Hey, Scott, I lost you for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. You know, Skype, it's, I gotta hand it to him. It's about 100% better quality than a landline. And yet, there's some kind of problem getting connected and getting the levels right and something every time. So it really kind of, is a wash. I don't know. Anyway. Hey, thanks for joining us on the show. I got the link here. I'm going to send you the link to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure on Netflix there.
Thank you.
So that you'll have it, and then that way you'll know history.
Thank you. I need to.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously. All right. No, seriously, though, Eric Margulies, he wrote history. He lived it and was there and reported all about it all over the entire planet. Longtime war reporter, foreign correspondent for Sun National Media back when. He writes for uns.com and for lourockwell.com. You can also find his website at ericmargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis, ericmargulies.com. And he's the author of the book War at the Top of the World, all about Kashmir and Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and all that mess over there. And then, of course, American Raj, Liberation or Domination, which is about the American Empire, mostly in the Middle East. Read those books. God dang it, they're really good. So I want to talk with you mostly about the war today, the Islamic State and all of that. But then again, I imagine that you probably have something worthwhile to say about the torture report. And so I thought I'd just kind of give you the floor. You could take that any way you want, if you want.
Well, every American citizen should have something strong to say about the torture report. I do, for sure.
Well, go on ahead. You have an open floor here.
Okay, well... I've been following this story since 2003. Most of the grisly details of the vile tortures inflicted on suspects or anti-Americans, who we call terrorists, have been reported in the media extensively. I've written about them in my columns. I find it horrifying. I always have that the United States government would indulge in these practices. Torture under American law is illegal. Under international law, it's illegal. It's un-American. It is, as has been said, even the president said it, totally against American values. But we did it. And the question is, if we don't punish the people who were guilty of this crime, because it was a war crime, it was a domestic crime in the United States under our law, if we don't punish the people responsible, we are condoning torture, and it will happen again. And the danger of torture, as I saw during the French repression of the Algerian Revolution in the 1950s, is that unless torture is stopped at its source, it will spread like a virus into domestic police forces and domestic security agencies and become par for the course. We can't allow this. My final point is, you know, there's an old Taoist saying, you become what you hate. And surely, as I read about these damned psychiatrists who were paid, or psychologists who were paid $81 million to devise tortures and the foul acts we inflicted on people, the kidnaps and the murders, etc., I used to think we were as bad as the Soviet Union, but now I realize to my horror that we've become worse than the old Soviet Union.
Well, and now, you know, on the part about, yeah, us becoming worse, and I'm an individualist, obviously. I don't mean to be too broad brush with the whole collective thing, this, that, the other. But then again, in 200 years, they'll say the Americans, fairly speaking. And what you're saying about it, how un-American all this is, the problem is,
is like, you know, like you're saying, without the accountability, it becomes American. It's not anti-American. It is American. You know, like when I was a kid, I heard of Chinese water torture. Like that's something from some barbaric medieval Chinese past where they would torture somebody with water like this or something. But this is not something that any civilized society would participate in at all. This is the fate worse than death. This is how we know that we're civilized, is because we don't do this. I mean, it's kind of as black and white as it could be. And what happens, because they've, especially Karl Rove and them, are so good at just turning this into a partisan issue where people just line up on their same old given sides and all this, they've actually, I think, already succeeded. Rice 2014, we're having this conversation here. They've already succeeded in convincing, you know, half the population, the right-leaning half of the population of this society, to give up on even the pretense that justice is our cause and our creed and the thing that we're interested in here. Fairness and liberty and justice for all. That's what makes America America. And Bush convinced them that, nope, screw justice, line up behind power. Conservative Republican power, and they made that deal with the devil. They're more than happy to. Hundreds of millions of Americans.
Well, that's right, and it's shocking to see. You know, we continue to castigate Nazi Germany. How could the Germans have allowed this to happen? How could the concentration camps, etc.? But look, here's a perfect example of a large group of people who are frightened or terrified, which is what's been happening, into closing their eyes and allowing the annulment of all our laws and traditions out of fear. Well, the Germans did it, and we've done it too. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Personally, I was asked to serve on the Church Commission way back when, in the late 70s?
Yeah.
That then investigated all the wrongdoings of the CIA. We probably need another purge of the CIA, but I have a caveat. And that is, having followed intelligence affairs very closely, that the CIA and its leaders would rarely do anything under their own initiative. They're bureaucrats. And I believe that Bush and Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, all those people have full responsibility for what happened. They know that they're scared to travel abroad because they might be arrested, and they probably should be. I add Mr. Blair to this list, too, and say that some kind of action has to be initiated against these people for breaking the law. But we have a Justice Department that is become a lapdog of the president, won't do anything on its own. And as you say, we don't have the indignation in America or the fact that the people are horrified by what happened. Oh, they're just Arabs. Who cares?
Right. Well, and that is the headline at USA Today. Justice Department will not reopen torture inquiry. And all they ever had was what started as the obstruction of justice inquiry into the destruction of the torture tapes, which the prosecutor then expanded to a preliminary investigation into the two cases of CIA murder. And Lawrence Wilkerson's going to be on the show in 20 minutes to talk about how the military murdered more than 100 people, tortured more than 100 people to death. But the CIA apparently, excluding down at Penny Lane, murdered two guys in Afghanistan. And he looked into that for a minute and then said, nah. That was as close as the Justice Department ever got to looking at torture at all, was simply the murders. Forget the torture. We got a memo. All right, one sec. More Eric Margulies in just a sec, y'all.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The Worst State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I got Eric Margulies on the line. We're talking about the evil American empire. Yeah, let's get back to that, what you said. Worse even than the commies, huh? Eric?
Well, yes, as I reflect back, I mean, the torture inflicted by the KGB, and I've been to the KGB's Lubyanka prison in Moscow. I've seen the cells. I've seen the torture devices. What we have done is as bad, if not worse, than KGB. It's the same old story, the freezing to death in people's cells, beating them to death, injecting them with psychotropic drugs, terrifying them, starving them, etc. It's worthy of a totalitarian police state. And I think that's what's happening now. As you know, we have a confluence of these crises. We have Snowden, who revealed how Big Brother is listening in and now probably starting to listen into us at night, too, in our bedrooms. We have the kidnapping of citizens. We have the assassination of American citizens. We have big steps forward to a police state. And if we don't dig in our heels over this torture issue and do something, the process towards a totalitarian state will continue.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing, man. It seems like we're really giving up, not we, but American society. So much of it has given up on, you know, keeping our priorities. You know, like people want to argue about Social Security payments, or they want to argue about, you know, whatever other kind of, you know, public policies, this and that. That's one thing. But there's supposed to be a 100% unanimous consensus by all Americans over the age of 18 that, no, we all insist on fair trials, even for child molesters and killers and murderers and terrorists. And we always will. We always insist on free speech. We always insist on search warrants. We always insist our police call us sir and ma'am and not treat us like we're damned dogs. And we always insist, et cetera, et cetera. Just the very basic things, peace. The very basic things that people at least used to think were the kind of very underlying basis of what it means to be American. Although, you know, you don't even hear people say, hey, this is America, to mean it's a free country anymore, right? They say it to justify evil sometimes, but they don't say it like, hey, so that's why you should back off, because it doesn't even mean that anymore.
That's right. Well, you know, it's after the Reichstag fire in Germany, and German parliament passed what was called enabling legislation. And within 6 months, for sure, all the safeguards of German democracy had been made void, and the Nazi Party took complete control. This is a terrifying example, because 9/11 was a similar example. Now that we're learning about all the horrors of the so-called war on terror, which I've always called a faux war on terror, and I refuse to use the word terror because it's a propaganda term, we should start questioning other things too. Let's go back to 9/11. We still wonder how much was covered up and obfuscated there. We're at a point now where we really don't trust our government. We should, as Americans. It's our government, but we are finding things that are more and more disturbing. And finally, you know, there's a movement afoot already. You can see it. Even though Dick Cheney, I just saw him on TV saying that Bush knew all about and authorized the torture from day one. Mm-hmm. So did he. There's a Bush movement saying, oh, well, you know, the president really didn't know about it, and he was misled by these evil CIA officials. That's the standard line. Well, it wasn't the CIA evil officials there, though there were some like Hayden. But this comes right from the White House. And fingerprints are all over these things. And we mustn't let the high officials escape, as happened in the question of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, where, you know, a couple of low-down people were left holding the bag and the big boys escaped.
Right. Well, so let me ask you this. Is it possible at all that Obama's our Gorbachev and that this will be the fall of the USSA here? I mean, there's a severe lack of confidence in government on all levels, right? The polls for the last few presidents and the last few Congresses, the approval ratings are as low as they have ever been. We have the crisis of our murderer police on the streets, still continuing protests and almost a dozen cities or something across America over police murder right now. We've got, of course, all the corruption of the bailout of all the banks and all the resentment for that that'll never go away. We got the endless wars and all the endless scaremongering propaganda, the torture report coming out. Is it possible that Americans could just give up their consensus for D.C. rule in the first place? Like, you know, if the Constitution doesn't bind their power, then how does it create their power anyway? If it's no law at all, then it's no law at all. We should be completely free of them.
Well, Scott, I don't see Obama as an American Gorbachev. I wish he had been, because we desperately need some glasnost, perestroika, and honesty and decency in Washington, which has become totally, but totally corrupted by money.
I guess I just meant in the sense of accidentally bringing the empire down, which is not what he meant to do, but sort of did anyway.
Gorbachev was a man of principle and conviction and honor.
Bad comparison. You're right.
Obama has none. He's just wishy-washy and won't take a position on anything. You know, I remember when I was in the military, there was a concept we called command responsibility. And if your ship hits a rock, well, the captain of that ship is responsible, even if he was fast asleep in his bunk. And but, you know, the idea of the buck stops here, or it happened on my watch, doesn't exist anymore amongst these low-grade politicians that we have in power. Somebody has got to take responsibility for this.
Yeah, time for an American spring, if you ask me. All right, so now I guess we can make – I wanted to kind of just talk all about the war with you, but it's still part and parcel of the same conversation. What about the next disaster? Because I know it's already ongoing, but then again, I'm predicting huge advances – and that's the wrong term for it incremental advances in the numbers of troops fighting in former Iraq and Syria and the Islamic State next spring, next summer. They say they are determined to sack Mosul and drive the Islamic State out of power there. Seems like, I don't know, if Afghanistan helped bring down the Soviet Union, seems like this terror war might just be able to break America's back and bank, you know, permanently, as it was meant to.
Well, certainly that's what Osama bin Laden said. He wanted to draw the U.S. into all these little Lilliputian wars and bleed the United States economy. The Iranian militants have said that to me, too. They said, let them invade Iran. We welcome them. America will break its teeth on Iran. So there's a lot to that. And what we see is Obama sneaking troops back into Iraq. What is this is really white officers leading native troops there. And it's an absurd situation. We have been at war in Iraq for, I think it's 13 years now. And we're deepening our involvement. I think ISIS barely exists. I think it's like another al-Qaeda that never had more than a couple of hundred people to begin with. The battle for Kobani on the Turkish border has been going on for months. Where heavy bombers are bombing it, and it's been called this Kurdish Stalingrad. And yet nothing has really happened. It's almost a theatrical rather than military event.
Yeah. Well, it seems like their ability to expand much further than they've already conquered is seriously in question. But then again, it doesn't seem like anybody's really coming for them. I mean, who's going to be able to kick them out of Mosul? And I don't even think the Peshmerga and the Americans are going to do it. It's going to take the American Marines, right?
Well, the Americans, don't forget that we Americans had 5,000 troops in Iraq before ISIS even appeared. They were, they had been kept there after the alleged U.S. withdrawal. They were as private contractors. You know, I love free enterprise in world affairs. We have private contractor torturers and now private contractors, security forces. These were U.S. military forces rebranded as private contractors. 5,000 based in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, which is with is one of the two biggest in the world, along with the embassy in Kabul. What Osama bin Laden called crusader fortresses, and they are. So we have mercenary troops who we're paying for there, among them these Peshmergas. So there's a lot of military involvement, and the U.S. military is just down the road in Kuwait. We have about 2 to 3 mechanized brigades based in Kuwait, which can be in Baghdad in a matter of hours. So we haven't really, we're gone, but we haven't left.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm predicting the worst there. It seems like really just the news cycle has already taken care of it. Americans, it's not like 02, 03 where people are really engaged and all right, even if they're for it, at least they're paying attention. There's a big war going on. Now it's like just another war when really, I mean, this thing, I don't see it. They claim that David Petraeus said the day that they were invading or the week of the initial invasion in 03 as they were rumbling toward Baghdad. So tell me how this ends. And I don't see an exit ramp here other than going back in time and electing Ron Paul in 2012 or something. Well, and even no, his son wants to full-on declare war like we haven't done to anyone since Hitler. So
we have the Republican jihadists waiting to take over in January. And a lot of these I used to be a Republican, by the way. I'm a fallen away Republican. A lot of these guys are very extreme. They have nothing to do with the old Republican Party that I belong to. They're Midwestern Prairie Bible Belt extremists, and they want more war. Just listen to them. The only, ironically, the only person who made sense really in Congress on the Republican side was John McCain, who actually saw war, was a prisoner, and denounced this whole torture episode. I see the other people, particularly this my own New York State ghastly Representative King, lauding torture and saying it's a wonderful thing. And the Republican Party has become the party of torture and warfare overseas. We should really call it by what it is, the Imperialist Party.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Eric. I'll let you go with that. I already kept you over, but I sure appreciate it. That's the great Eric Margulies, everybody. War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination are the books. Check them out. Get them at Amazon. You can find them at scotthorton.org/books, in fact. And also check out all his great articles at ericmargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis, lourockwell.com, and unz.com. That's U-N-Z, unz.com. We'll be right back with Lawrence Wilkerson right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm live noon to 2 here on the Liberty Radio Network on the weekdays.
can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. And next up is retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He's a professor teaching national security now at William & Mary. And he was formerly the aide, right-hand man to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Welcome back to the show. How's it going, Larry?
Going well. Hope so with you, too.
Yeah, doing great. It's been a long time since we've spoken. I'm happy to have you back on the show. And I guess this is usually the subject that we talk about, though not always. Of course, the torture report. But first of all, I'll ask you if you could to please introduce yourself to the audience a little bit better than I did, and especially along the lines of what your relationship was to Secretary of State Powell, who, of course, before that was, you know, out of government, but before that was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan and all these other things.
Yeah, well, I joined him in 1989 after I left the U.S. Naval War College where I'd been teaching somewhat reluctantly because I enjoyed it there, and I told him that, and he said later that was the reason he hired me, because I wasn't a Cassius with a lean and hungry look. I worked for him from 89 all the way through the end of his chairmanship, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course, in 1993. And then I moved to the Marine Corps War College to finish my 31 years in the military, and then joined him in a private capacity from 1998, roughly, to 2000, and then went with him to the State Department to first work on his policy planning staff under Ambassador Richard Haass, and then later for almost 3 years to be his chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. And then I think it's fair to say, right, you helped him lie us all into war back in 2003, and I know you've said you're sorry for it before, so you want to tell us that story very briefly here?
Well, I think that's true. It's too succinct, if I may say so, not to excuse myself, but it was a very complex situation where at the almost last minute, the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, called and said that Powell would be giving a presentation at the United Nations before the Security Council that would sort of sum up the U.S. position with regard to its intelligence on Iraq's, as we called it, and everyone seems to forget this, the title of the presentation was A Failure to Disarm. So this was a contention that Saddam Hussein had not abided by the U.N. Security Council resolutions that asked him, directed him to disarm, and we were going to show the evidence that we had that proved that. And my first reaction to this demand of me to put this presentation together was, hey, boss, not enough time. And he acknowledged that and called Condi, and Condi promised to see if she could get it extended, and then later said no, she couldn't because the public announcement had already been made, and therefore the president was not going to change the date. Well, my first reaction was not one of I can't do this because of moral reasons or because I didn't believe in the situation. It was I can't do this, period. I can't possibly get this man ready for this kind of presentation at the United Nations on this complex situation in 5 days and five nights. So I kind of wrote out my resignation, called my wife and said, hey, you're going to see me coming home, because he's just once again giving me one of these tasks that he'll give to no one else that I simply can't carry out, and I'm not going to sit around and take it. As I consulted with my wife and as I consulted with members of the team that he had garnered for me from the National Security Council staff, otherwise in the White House and elsewhere in the bureaucracy, I began to see that maybe it wasn't quite as technically impossible as I had first thought it was, because we did have quite a bit of data. And so I reluctantly agreed to go ahead and do it, and you know what the result was. We tortured ourselves for 5 days and nights at the CIA in George Tenet's conference room, and then we tortured ourselves a little bit more in New York at the U.S. mission, U.N. mission in New York, where we did our final dress rehearsal. And then we ultimately tortured ourselves before the U.N. Security Council on 5 February, where we delivered about an hour 20 presentation, in which there were many facts that were valid, but there were several that were invalid, and they were the most salient facts: the mobile biological weapons labs, which he, of course, did not have, the existing stockpiles of chemical weapons, which, of course, he did not have, the connections with Al-Qaeda, which, of course, he did not have, and the enormous program, active program, to create a nuclear weapon, which, of course, he did not have. Those were all false components of that presentation, false components of the U.S. intelligence community, and for that matter, other intelligence communities, too, who had been consulting with the U.S., Israel, France, Britain, for example, Germany. And that's the end of it. We essentially presented a case for war that was, in its essentials, invalid.
Yeah. All right. And now, so does that have much to do with why you're so outspoken about, for example, the torture regime now, or that's its own separate thing, or this is really kind of an attempt to make up for such a horrible mistake? Although, well, and let me push back a little on the mistake. I mean, when there's so much has been told of this story before, all the pushback, as you said, going through torture, dealing with the neocons, dealing with the CIA about what to be, what is to be included in the presentation, and what is not. I mean, you had to know that Scooter Libby, on behalf of Dick Cheney, was pushing to lie us into war. And if you guys were trying to cross out as much of the completely ridiculous, blatant lies as possible and leave only the very best ones in there, you still had to recognize that that was the process that you were working on here, was how to convince the American people to support this thing that is unsupported by the facts, right?
Yeah, that's not completely true. In retrospect, I might find myself agreeing with you more or less, but at the time, it certainly was not the consensus view. The consensus view of 16 different entities in the $80 billion U.S. intelligence community was that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. It was reflected in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, which incidentally is what we finally turned to. Your argument about Scooter Libby's script, we threw that out. Within 8 hours of my being at Langley, yeah, I turned to Tenet and I said, this is impossible. We cannot use this. It's unsourced. Throw it out. And he agreed and threw it out and brought the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate forward. And from that point on, we proceeded on that consensus document of the entire U.S. intelligence community.
Right.
The only dissenting voice in that document was my own, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Our department, under Carl Ford, the Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, had in fact said in a dissenting voice that was footnoted in the NIE that Iraq did not have, by their estimate, an active nuclear weapons program. So that was the only dissent in that document from, as I said, the $80 billion U.S. intelligence community, which includes the DIA, the NSA, all of the services intelligence assets, the CIA. It was entirely an intelligence document. It was presented by the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, representing all those entities to the Secretary and to me as the considered opinion of the professionals in the U.S. intelligence community.
Right. Now, of course, in hindsight, you know that there were 150 million Americans who knew that it was a bunch of crap and who were all protesting in the streets and who could read Scott Ritter or any number of other
high.
Ray McGovern or all these outside experts, the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity.
If you could get 150 million Americans apathetic as they are,
well,
interested in anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, the support for that war was about 50-50. And the people who lean left or libertarian, they just didn't believe it because it was unbelievable. Oh, well, the president has secret information we can't tell you. Yeah, that's because it's a bunch of crap. Every cab driver and bartender in Austin, Texas knew that. I could testify to that. I debunked Colin Powell's speech live in real time as I was painting a house with a friend listening to the presentation on NPR and saying, nope, that was debunked in the Washington Post. That was debunked here, there, and the other place live in real time. And I was nobody. I was a laid off cab driver at the time.
Well,
and I still knew better. But hang on 1 second. I'm sorry, we got to take this break.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't be lecturing you so damn much. I want to ask you about torture. But hang on right there, everybody. It's Larry Wilkerson. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation.
And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. My guest is Larry Wilkerson, and the hard breaks are almost as rude as I am, so I will now let you go ahead and finish up and get the last word about the UN presentation, the getting us into war and your role and all of that and whatever, because I didn't mean to just, you know, end that up with a bunch of accusations, so go ahead.
No, I take what you say in stride. A lot of it's true. I will say that the New York Times op-ed page and the Washington Post op-ed page under Fred Hyde were egging us on.
They weren't telling us we were wrong. Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely true. I was, you know what I was thinking of, and I'll never forget this. It was the top headline on antiwar.com was "The aluminum tubes are for rockets," says all these experts. And it even said back then, I don't know if the Post still does this, but back then the Washington Post website pages would tell you which page of the newspaper it ran on. And so there it was, page A38 or something, is "Everyone who knows anything about centrifuges that works for the U.S. government except this one liar named Joe at the CIA all agree that these couldn't possibly be for centrifuges. It's just not true." And that was in September of 2002, which means every time anybody claimed that there was something to be feared from them damned aluminum tubes after that, to me, was just the most laughable and insulting and ridiculous thing. I couldn't believe it. That don't they know that the Washington freaking Post already explained that's just not true, and they used it 1,000 more times. You too.
Well, the unfortunate thing that I learned later was that when the intelligence community came together to vote on the issue of the aluminum tubes as to what they represented, the member of the Department of Energy who was most adamantly opposed to Joe T's recommendations, to his appraisal, to his assessment, was absent. And therefore, the intelligence community achieved a consensus it probably shouldn't have achieved.
Yeah.
And I also learned that George Tenet had taken advantage of, through John McLaughlin, his deputy, and scheduling, the absence of this guy from the Department of Energy. So this is why I lied over into the torture issue and say I have no problem at all believing the congressional report, the Sissy report, that says the CIA lied to the Congress, because they lied blatantly to me and to Secretary Powell.
Right. And now you mentioned on TV, I think 2 days ago, about Sheikh Al-Libi and how they brought the CIA, not the neocons in the Pentagon, the CIA brought to you information, to you meaning Colin Powell, information from Ibn Sheikh Al-Libi, who was tortured, I believe, by the Egyptians into pointing his finger at Saddam Hussein for training Al-Qaeda how to make chemical weapons and how to hijack airliners. And they brought you all that information. Now, I forget, was that included in the presentation?
Well, yeah, and the circumstances of that were quite stunning. Powell had grabbed me, physically grabbed me, in the corridor outside the Tenet's conference room on the top floor of the CIA, and pushed me into a room that we both knew was vacant and we both hoped was not bugged. And he sat me down, and he had never in our entire relationship treated me this way before. And so I knew something was up. And he just unloaded on me, one-on-one. He unloaded on me, saying, "Take this crap out. It stinks. I am not going to say this before the UN. This is junk. This is total junk." And he was referring to the some 20 pages or so on Saddam's contacts with Al-Qaeda and terrorists in general. He was absolutely furious about it. And I said, "Calm down, boss. I'm of the same mind you are. It stinks. And I will take it out. I will extract it." He said, "Good." And he got up and walked out of the room. I got up and adjusted my coat, which was a little disheveled, and walked out behind him. Within an hour, George Tenet made an appearance in the conference room during our beginning of the rehearsal that night and laid a bombshell on the table. And he didn't name anybody. He didn't render a single name. He said, quote, a high-level Al-Qaeda operative, unquote. That's all he said. Then he went on to say a high-level Al-Qaeda operative had been interrogated, and intimating it was recently. Only later did I learn it was weeks before, months before. And that under interrogation, he had revealed significant contacts between Baghdad's Mukhabarat, the secret police, and Al-Qaeda operatives. And that had included training them in the use of biological chemical weapons and other things. He went on in some detail to describe these contacts. When he finished, there was a silence in the room for a few minutes. And then Powell turned to me and he said, put it back in. And I knew what he meant. I knew exactly what he meant. Put the stuff that we just both decided was garbage and should be extracted back into his presentation. And so, from that moment on, I did everything I could to possibly call what was in there on that subject. It got so bad that at the Waldorf Astoria at 2 a.m. in the morning, in the suite just below the Secretary of State's suite there, which is maintained there all the time, I had a room, and I was doing some final adjustments to the script for his presentation that morning at 9 a.m. And I was taking out, at that point even, at that late moment, I was taking out some of this garbage. And Phil Mudd, who's now on TV every day exclaiming the sobriety and sanity and the quality of the CIA's torture program, he was standing behind me, protesting vigorously and trying to get me to stick the things back in. So vigorously, I finally turned around and said, Phil, I'm going to kick you out of this room if you don't go out voluntarily. Get out of here. And he then went to the other hotel where George Tenet was staying and woke him up and told him that I was making major changes to the script. How did I know that? Because the next morning, about 8 o'clock on the floor of the UN Security Council, when we were setting up for the presentation, Tenet came up to me and said, I understand you were making changes to the presentation last night, blah, 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 blah. And I told him essentially what I was doing. And to George's credit, he said, I'm not worried. I'm sorry he woke me up and went back and sat down in his place. But that's how Phil was trying to the very last moment, this guy who is now extolling the virtues of the CIA and asserting that it would never lie and all this kind of crap, he's the guy who's sitting in that hotel room that early that morning trying to get me to put this garbage back into his presentation, this garbage which is essentially lies.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when George Tenet tells you, hey, I have information from a high-level CIA operative, and we interrogated him, and he admitted that he's best friends with Saddam Hussein, you didn't suspect that that was a lie or that maybe it had been beaten out of some poor guy or what? You thought, well, geez, if you say so, George Tenet, after all that already?
Hey, this is the Director of Central Intelligence of the United States of America speaking to the Secretary of State of the United States of America with the National Security Advisor sitting there, with the Deputy Secretary of State sitting there, mm-hmm. with all manner of other lesser people sitting there in the bowels of the CIA. I'm the Chief of Staff of the State Department, and I'm going to stand up and tell the DCI that he's wrong?
Right. I understand. Now, listen, let me keep you one more segment, please. Can you?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Hang tight right there. Everybody, it's Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel, retired, former right-hand man to Colin Powell. We'll be right back. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Lawrence Wilkerson. He was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force, was right-hand man to Colin Powell, the Secretary of State,
and back when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, too. He teaches national security at William & Mary. And this is why I had you on, Larry, in the first place, is because I wanted to ask you to please tell me everything that you can about Dick Cheney's role in orchestrating the torture program. He was on TV last night saying, I supported it. You're damn right. I supported it, supported it, supported it. Oh, coming up with it? Well, you know, that was the lawyers in them. But I think it was a good idea, which is apparently the only question about his participation. Because after all, he's just the vice president. And the vice president, that office is worth a bucket of warm spit. As everybody knows, he has no real authority. So what does he have to do with anything other than agreeing that it was certainly the wise decision to make to keep the American people safe?
Not with Dick Cheney. That office became an alter ego and even a superior ego for the presidency of the United States from 2001 to 2005 under Dick Cheney. For national security and foreign policy, and for some domestic policy, which is revealed in Bart Gellman's book, Angler, Cheney was the decision maker. There's no question about it. He was the decision maker. And with regard to your specific question, Cheney was both the instigator of the legal review through his clever lawyer, whose opinions were so weird that when he was Cheney's assistant in the Pentagon, we called him Weird David. Of course, I'm referring to David Addington. And he was also the orchestrator of the actual procedural review and the procedural acceptance by the CIA and ultimately through Donald Rumsfeld, the military. So what do I mean by that? Well, Cheney orchestrated the legal review that would produce ultimately the Bybee memo and other documents that in the most strained legal fashion I've ever been associated with said torture was not torture. That's essentially what they did. They said torture was not torture. The famous paragraph, of course, is where you compares torture in its essence as being organ failure or death. Obviously, John Hughes never experienced waterboarding or any of the other hypothermic chambers, isolation, no sleep, and so forth and so on, all of which, as Alberto Moro, JAG for the Navy, pointed out, in combination and over time constitute torture. So that was the one side that Cheney orchestrated and had a heavy hand in through Addington, was the kind of tortured, if I may, legal review. And then on the other side, he set up the procedural aspects of the CIA, gave them permission to do what they did, and through Rumsfeld actually involved the armed forces in it. And then came the usual bureaucratic competition between the agency, the CIA, and the Defense Department, where Rumsfeld was trying to outdo the agency, and the agency was out trying to outdo the Defense Department. And it came together at Guantanamo, of course, and at other places. But it was an unhealthy competition in that regard, because Rumsfeld didn't trust the intelligence the agency was gaining through its program, and the agency, of course, didn't give a damn for Rumsfeld's intelligence. So Rumsfeld set up his own separate effort that involved the armed forces in torture, which was the occasion for me to get involved in it and become outspoken, because I thought that was probably one of the most contaminative and insidious things anybody had ever done, authorized the armed forces to torture people.
And when did you first become aware of that?
I came aware of it in the days before the actual presentation on television of some of the images from Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq. Powell walked into my office.
So that's the spring of 04, right?
Yeah, he walked into my office and he said, as I recall, it was April or May. And he said, there's going to be some photographs come out, and they're going to be terrible, and they're coming from a place called Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and they show our soldiers essentially treating prisoners really badly. I want you to get to the bottom of it, he said. I've got Will Taft, William Howard Taft IV, was Powell's legal counsel, his lawyer. I've got him working the legal side of the house. I want you to look at the TikTok. I want you to figure out the chronology. How did we get here? I want you to figure out who did it and so forth and so on. And over the next 6 or 7 months, I built up a hell of a dossier on it, mostly open source, some classified documents. To give you some idea, the open source documents fill my office in one corner from the floor to the ceiling in two columns. And the classified documents fill a drawer and a half in my safe. These documents showed me and and I think showed Powell ultimately how we had gotten to the point we'd gotten to. And the thing that struck me as most dramatic, I knew that these kinds of things had happened in the past. They happened in the Philippines. They happened in Vietnam. I knew that the armed forces had from time to time done some things that were illegal against international law, as well as the law of land warfare, the Geneva Conventions and so forth, Phoenix Program in Vietnam, for example, the slaughter of Filipino insurgents in the Philippines at the turn of the century. But I didn't think it had ever been authorized at the highest levels in the country. That's what struck me as unique about this situation, that this kind of behavior had been authorized at the highest policy levels in the land, in terms of the White House by the vice president, and in terms of the Pentagon, of course, by Rumsfeld, and in terms of the CIA by the National Security Advisor, the vice president, and the director of Central Intelligence. So this was stunning to me to find out that these weren't, this was not just as a result of some bad apples, as Rumsfeld tried to blame it on, out in the military, which had happened, as I said, in the past. It was a result of the very highest policy levels in the United States deciding to torture people.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, a couple of things in a very short amount of time left here. First of all, as far as Cheney's role, you say he ordered the review. He basically got the ball rolling. Anything more you can tell us about, you know, the influence? Like, for example, it's quite apparent that they were, you know, really seeking, you know, Saddam, Al-Qaeda links. Do you know, did Cheney say, like, get me some lies about Saddam and Osama? Was it that blatant?
What I discovered and what I reinforced in terms of my discovery after I left office was the fact that we had shifted, or at least made an equal priority, in early spring of 2002. We had made almost an equal priority with stalling another attack, preventing another attack on the United States, another attack like 9/11. We had made an equal priority of finding out from people contacts, you know, firm contacts between Al-Qaeda and hopefully even the attacks themselves, and Baghdad, and that this was as much an impetus for the enhanced interrogation techniques as was trying to stop another attack. And this was insanity to me, because
beginning in spring '02
to build a reason for war that had nothing to do with preventing another attack on the United States.
And you saw that change began in the spring of 2002, right around the time Bush announced that he was not that concerned about bin Laden.
Yes. As a matter of fact, about the same time.
Yeah, isn't that something? And then, I'm sorry, we're over time, or we're going to be, but can you please tell me briefly about your statements in the past about, you know, that more than 100 men were, if not outright each, tortured to death, at least died in military custody under these same rules. Because, of course, we're only hearing about the CIA and maybe one or two people that died at the salt pit, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, the Human Rights First put out a report in 2005 or 6. I've got a copy of it downstairs. And that report documented 139 people dying. And the phrase that I recall is while in custody. Now, that could have been contractor custody, CIA custody, military custody, whatever. If you think about it for a moment, when you consider the number of prisoners we had, that's not an unusual figure. It's not an unusual percentage. The circumstances under which they died became the unusual or unique thing. And what Human Rights First found, as I recall, was that anywhere from 25 to 40 of those deaths were either judged by coroners, official coroners, in most cases military, as being homicides, or judged by someone outside the system but called into the system for that judgment to be homicides. So here you've got, in detention, these people dying, some of them from heart attacks, some of them from old age, you name it. That's just to be expected. But you've got a good portion of them dying from being murdered. And, of course, the most prominent case was Dilawar in Afghanistan, whom Alex Gibney made the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side about.
Right.
But I've seen nothing since then official, and I'm eager to look at this Senate report to see if there is anything in there to find out what these other homicides were judged to be. Were they a product of contractor negligence, CIA negligence, military negligence, or whatever? No one has really come up with a good answer to that, as far as I know.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm sorry. I dropped the ball on a follow-up there a second ago, just if you could, real quick, about was it Cheney, when you saw in spring of 2002 about the change from, you know, let's find out everything we can about Al-Qaeda as part of the motive of torturing, to really let's find out what we can about Saddam and Al-Qaeda as the whole new thing to try to build the case, as you said. Could you trace that part back to Cheney? See, I was unaware that you had written this entire review for Powell about how we got in there and everything. Any chance you'll ever leak that thing? I want to read it.
I think you can assume, and with some strong credibility, that it was Cheney, because Cheney was the one whose chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and other staffer, John Hanna, who came with me to the CIA to protect his interest, protect the vice president's interest, they were the ones who were compiling this data for the script that would be the 48-page script on Saddam Hussein that would be handed to me initially for Powell's presentation at the UN. So if they were working on this script, if they were putting together the, quote, case for Iraq's possession of WMD, unquote, and that included Iraq's contacts with Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, then I have to assume, I mean, it's a pretty strong, I think, and firm assumption that they were the ones who started this effort to find intelligence to feed that. Now, there were other people involved in it. Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Policy at the Defense Department, was heavily involved in it, a lawyer himself. There were six lawyers involved in the legal opinion, for example, Feith, Gonzalez, Bybee, Bill Haynes at the State Department, or at the Defense Department, General Counsel for Rumsfeld, and then, of course, David Addington at the Vice President's Office. So these six lawyers, at a minimum, should be disbarred for what they did. But they were integral to the effort to combine the legal opinion with the intelligence that was being gathered and to put it all in that script that Scooter Libby was working on.
Right. All right. Well, with that, I'll let you go. But thank you for your time, and especially for staying overtime with us today, Larry.
Surely. Take care.
Appreciate it. All right. That's Lawrence Wilkerson, retired colonel in the U.S. Air Force and former right-hand man to Colin Powell. Right now, he teaches national security at William & Mary. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
I am so friggin' hungry. Thank God, the show is almost over. I think I'm going to make a sandwich. Yeah. With mustard.
It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I kept him into that break. The one more thing there. 139, he says. He was referencing a Human Rights First study there. 139 killed in custody. Most of them tortured to death. Some of them, like the cops say, yeah, we tasered the crap out of the guy, but he died of a heart attack. I'm sure there's plenty of those in there, too. So just always remember that about this current report. This is not about the rendition program. This does not explain about all the people who the CIA sent to Syria, Egypt, Libya, other countries to be tortured by their security forces, you know. Secret torture police. This is only about the ones they tortured. And it's not about all the people that Donald Rumsfeld tortured, which would be a book the size of two stacks of documents in the corner of your office there. Man. So anyway, I asked him, hey, you ever going to leak that? He didn't answer that. But I asked too many questions at once. But yeah, so I didn't realize. Colin Powell asked Larry Wilkerson when the Abu Ghraib pictures were coming out. Hey, I want you to figure out, I want you to do a massive study in what the hell happened here and how it came to be this way for me, to let him know, full of classified stuff, just for the boss. Wouldn't that be great?
Lawrence Wilkerson's History of the Torture Program that he wrote for Colin Powell circa 2004? Badass. Somebody put that shit on WikiLeaks. Oops, I mean, stuff. Put that on WikiLeaks. Something else. All right, listen. So I didn't get a chance to talk about the Syria stuff with Eric Margulies the way I wanted to. So let me tell you this. UN details Israeli military ties with Syrian rebels. UN observers saw Israeli troops transfer boxes to rebels. Long suspected, of course. Everybody knows. Why is America taking the side of our enemies in Syria? Because that's what Israel wants. Because their enemies are the Iranians and the Iranians' friends, the Syrians and Hezbollah. And whereas our enemies are Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, well, I think they shouldn't be the Islamic State, and I'm not saying I'm for fighting Al-Qaeda in Syria, I'm just saying, certainly those guys are not our friends. People are saying, yeah, you know, when you look back at the Ronald Reagan years, it makes you wonder what the rebels we back in Syria might become someday. Yeah, they already turned into the Islamic State. The blowback is already backdraft. It's the giant fireball singeing your skin off your face. That's your, you know, Bin Laden is to the Mujahideen war in Afghanistan in the 1980s as the Caliph Baghdadi is to American support for the Mujahideen in Syria over the last 3 years. It's the quickening. The blowback just keeps getting, so quick, so fast, that you're still looking for it after it already blew your head off. Dummies. It's behind you. And all around you. Anyway, point is, yeah, I'm off on a tangent. There's so much to talk about the Islamic State thing. Here's back to the original tangent. Always is suspected the Israelis would be doing something. We know they've been doing airstrikes against Syrian regime targets off and on for a few years now. And here they are. UN observers have seen the Israelis directly arming the rebels. Remember, Landay said, oh, there are moderates. They're being trained in Jordan. I've seen them. I've been there. I met with the CIA guys. I saw the guys training. But they're not really a force to be reckoned with. They're basically the border guards. America's policy has degraded Assad's power so much over the last 3 years that they got to hire the FSA to be the new border troops protecting Israel and Israel's ally Jordan from Islamic State and al-Nusra fighters. That's basically all they are. That's all they're good for is holding the border. They're not a force to be reckoned with at all. But anyway, so here's the Israelis directly arming them. So now, I mean, you can add with your footnote, UN observers, UN peacekeepers saw them with their own eyes. It's America, Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, and Israel supporting the Mujahideen in Syria all this time, even after the creation of the Islamic State, which is the biggest PR failure in the history of the American Empire. But, oh well, no problem, just keep doing the same damn thing anyway. There's an article about this at Vice News as well. You can read about it. Of course, that article was Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. UN details Israeli military ties with Syrian rebels. And it's in Haaretz and also at vice.com. Hilarious. Oh man, what was I going to say? I had one more thing about that here. Oh, here it was. On the other hand, U.S. stops paying northern Syria rebel salaries. So the FSA in the north, the CIA is cutting them off. They already cut the FSA leadership in Qatar and Turkey out of the loop. And the CIA was directly running the small FSA brigades on the ground there. You won't hear me call them moderates. They're not. But the small FSA brigades on the ground. Now they've cut off even the ones in the north. And then, but they're still supporting the ones in the south with the help of directly, with the help of the Israelis. And this is right after the Israelis were striking what was said to be anti-aircraft being installed
but before it was operational near the Damascus airport. And then, where in the hell is my other Syria article, damn it? I have here a very important Syria article that says, here, it's at Foreign Policy, State Department, rebels are never going to defeat Assad militarily. This is by John Hudson, and I admit I haven't read it yet, but very briefly, I've been trying to explain the split in America's Syria policy here. Obviously, us non-interventionists don't have a say in the fight. The only question inside the Oval Office is between evil and absolutely insane and evil. And so evil would be outright siding with the Shiites, as we have been doing since 2003 in the sectarian civil war over there, which is really much more a Tehran versus Riyadh war. Iran, the state, versus Saudi Arabia, the state, and their political leaders war. But America has helped them make it so bad for so long that it is really taking on a pretty bad sectarian, you know, religious hue to it, where people really are being killed just for being blasphemers now, whereas before it was for, you know, actually being opposition power in the way, that kind of, you know, real world stuff. But anyway, it would be absolutely horrible and evil for America to continue to back Iran and their sock puppets in Iraq. And it's just as evil, or more, it's double, to do the exact same thing in Syria, which would mean backing Iran's friends, Assad and his dictatorship, against the Islamic State. It would work, probably, if America just really armed and paid the hell out of Bashar al-Assad. He could probably kill the Islamic State and al-Nusra too, and reestablish the Syrian state all the way to the old Sykes-Picot line if they gave him enough money to do it. He's got an army. He's got weapons. Hell, if we just back the hell off and let Russia arm him, he could finish these guys off. I'm not recommending that. I'm just trying to paint the picture of what the reality is over there. Okay, but then here is the other choice of the policy, according to the Americans, is absolutely insane and evil. And that is, no, we just got to insist on regime change against Assad, de-Baathification of the government, abolition of the Syrian army, and an entire new era of sectarian civil war between the Sunni jihadists and the Christians, the Shia, the Druze, the Kurds, and everybody else there, which would be an absolute nightmare. Where if you think that the civil war that has killed at least a few hundred thousand people on both sides, 200,000 or 300,000 people on both sides have died in the civil war over the last 3 years, that's nothing compared to what is going to happen after the dissolution of the state there. And yet that is the policy that America is continuing to push, that we back Iran and the Shiites in Iraq, but we back Saudi and Turkey and their jihadi sock puppets in Syria against Iran. And then supposedly the new moderate force, FSA plus from the ether, I don't know where they're supposed to come from, this new moderate army that we saw what happened with the army they created in Iraq. But no, the new moderate army in Syria is supposed to then take on Assad and his army and Hezbollah on one side with and al-Nusra and the Islamic State on the other. And that's the policy that the Israeli lobby and therefore the U.S. Congress wants in D.C. Here is an indicator that Obama is going with the former policy, evil as hell, but not as insane, which is abandon the so-called moderate rebels because they're BS anyway.